coming up at 9, One Land Many Voices explores the political, social, and cultural issues affecting Israel and Palestine. At 10, Voices for the Animals, host Dab Stedman talks to Carrie Teal, co-founder and executive director of Gray 2K USA Worldwide, an organization dedicated to ending the cruelty of dog racing both in the States and abroad. At 10:30, Film at 11 focuses on dramas and documentaries about Stonewall, the place and the event that gave birth to the gay rights movement, with special guest Stefan Silvis. And at 11, Making Contact brings a special Beyond Stonewall. Then at 11:30, Outcasting, veteran gay journalist and activist Andy Hum about the historical progression of LGBTQ life and activism since before Stonewall. Don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. To become a member, go to KBOO.fm or use the mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for One Land Many Voices right after these important announcements.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. The Waterfront Blues Festival is the largest blues festival west of the Mississippi. The festival features more than 100 performances on four stages, including the Robert Cray Band, St. Paul and the Broken Bones, Trombone Shorty, and Vintage Trouble. There will also be workshops, cruises on the Willamette River, activities for kids, after-hour jams, fireworks, and more. Again, that's the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KBOO Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all of our members. Please consider applying to become a KBOO board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 13th, 2019. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and who want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
Tonight, people running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains, just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
Good morning. Thanks for tuning in to One Land Many Voices on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Leila Kanan, and today I'll be interviewing Rami El-Mahdi, a journalist and lecturer from the Gaza Strip, will be discussing his experience as a journalist in Gaza and the general on-the-ground situation that Gazans and Palestinians face every day. So stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Rami. I'm so excited to have you.
Yes. Thank you for hosting me, for calling me for today.
Of course.
My name is Rami Al-Mirari. I am a long-time journalist and lecturer, university lecturer based in the Gaza Strip. I've been working for different media outlets around the world, including radio, print, and TV. And still work is going on. And that's what I can say about myself so far.
Wonderful. So since you just brought up that you're a long-term journalist, let's talk about press censorship in Gaza. What is your experience as a journalist living in Gaza with the siege, with, you know, press being targeted during the Great March of Return? Can you go into that a little bit?
It's absolutely a scary situation for all the journalists and other residents in the Gaza Strip, particularly journalists who are being exposed to some dangers and risks doing the work throughout the region, and different occasions in Gaza, mainly the occasions of the wars or the attacks, the larger scale Israeli attacks against the Gaza Strip. Journalists happen to be exposed to dangers and risks caused by these Israeli attacks on the region from time to time, frequently over the past 10 years. Or since 2006, Gaza has experienced a number of large-scale attacks, mainly full-scale attacks, including the 2014 war and the latest, I mean, the 2009 and 8, the 2006, and the 2012. These attacks always expose and cause harm to the journalists. Many journalists have been killed throughout their works, and others have been injured. I myself, as a journalist, experienced a number of risky situations throughout the past years, including the latest in 2014, when I was going back, wrapping up my work and going back home. I was riding a cab, and suddenly, out of a sudden, an Israeli drone hit a motorcycle riding on which two people were riding, and the two people were injured severely. This was a very horrific situation, and that's when I saw it. I imagined if I would have been the one closer to this attack, I would have been harmed absolutely. And moving in the war-hit region like this. This one, moving on the street is risky. When you move from place to another, you have to take the most. You have to take some cautionary actions, even though these cautionary actions are not workable when there is an intensity of the Israeli attacks from the air and from the land. That is a very scary situation, by the way. In recent year, in the last year, there has been the Great March of Return, in which Israel used lethal force against Palestinians, journalists, civilians, and those protesting on the border lines. And when you approach the border fence trying to cover your story about the Great March of Return, you are exposed to some inhalation of tear gas being fired by the Israelis from time during the protest itself. Also, you might be wounded, you might be killed by means of the Israeli live ammunition that is fired on the protesters, and you might be aware of the fact that that so far about 2 to 3 journalists have been killed during the protest, the coverage of the protests, and about 170 others or more, even more, have been killed by a way or another during these marches of the Great March of Return on the border lines. This is in brief about how the situation looks like for journalists working in this war zone or this conflict zone in the Gaza Strip, where the escalation comes and the Israeli attacks against Gaza, violence and counter violence. This is a very scary situation for not only for journalists, but also for everybody living in this part of the world.
You mentioned restriction of movement in Gaza imposed by the Israelis. I'm wondering, how are you able to operate under these conditions, and how do you work around them?
The restrictions on the border lines are very high, actually. You know that Gaza is being besieged by the Israelis, and the only outlet, the two main outlets for Palestinians to go out from the region, is the Israel-controlled Erez checkpoint on the north of the Gaza Strip and the Egyptian-controlled Rafah crossing terminal in south of the Gaza Strip. Movement on the Israel-controlled Erez checkpoint is being controlled and governed by a heap of restrictions imposed by the Israelis in terms of the travel permission, in terms of the process of getting a travel permission in from Gaza to outside world. Only the category that is the main category that is going back and forth, or the main one that is going back and forth, is the category of Palestinian patients who are in need for medical treatment or medical intervention outside of the region, especially in the West Bank-based hospitals and the Israeli hospitals themselves as well. This is the main category. Other categories of travelers from Gaza, and these also, these patients face some restrictions, face some turning away, turning them down. The Israelis turn them down sometimes, and there are cases of patients being turned down by the Israelis when they reach the Erez checkpoint. Some other patients are facing some threats by the Israelis, and this is absolutely shown by the human rights groups. You can go back to human rights groups and to see a number of cases, several cases, but many cases of these people facing these troubles and facing these restrictions. Let's go to the Rafah crossing terminal, which is controlled by Egypt, and this crossing terminal reopens frequently by the Egyptians, depending on the situation, depending on the security situation in Gaza. When there is a sort of escalation by the Israelis, the Egyptians reopen the Rafah crossing terminal to allow entry of patients and those wounded by Israel, by the way. That's what the main categories of people traveling, and those who are having permanent residency permits in Arab countries or other regions of the world, students who are in need for pursuing their studies outside of Gaza, and the movement is very restricted. Not all the people can go out of the territory. Egyptians themselves also turned down many Palestinian travelers from Gaza on daily basis when the Rafah crossing is reopened. We hear about 20 to 30 cases or to 30 travelers being turned down daily by the Egyptians in times of the reopening. The reopening of the Rafah crossing terminal also is not that normal for Palestinians. It comes in up from abnormal situations, abnormal times. As I just mentioned, that when Israelis escalate in Gaza, Egyptians allow entry of some goods and commodities into the Strip, into the Gaza Strip, to try to help relieve the troubled region. I'd like also to hint at some other commercial crossings that are open. The only commercial crossing for Gaza is the Kerem Abu Salem, or the Hebrew name for it is the Kerem Shalom crossing in south of the territory, through which Israel allows entry and import and export at some limited cases. I just emphasize on this, some limited cases, export of some goods from Gaza. You know, imports and exports are being very restricted in the Gaza Strip because of the Israeli blockade on the region. The import of goods also is very restricted, and the example of this is the Israeli the Israeli, let me say, prohibition and prevention of entry of hundreds of items of goods under what Israel always claims and alleges, that these goods are being double used goods that Israel wants to prevent them from entering because of the siege being imposed on Gaza to further cripple the situation. Although life might seem going on, for money, but in fact and in depth, the siege is being inflicted, is affecting life here very credibly and very seriously and very ostensibly, by the way, in the sense that many people are being jobless here in Gaza. Hundreds of thousands of people are being jobless. Unemployment is very low. Unemployment is very high, actually. Poverty is very high as well. About 45% of Gaza's labor force are not being able to have or to access to jobs, as well as according to statistics, about 60% of the population, or more than 60% of the population, live beyond or under a poverty line, which are very high for a population like the population of about 1 million residents are living in such a situation. This is this number of people in Gaza, the 2 million populated, the 2 million residents of the Gaza Strip, might equal in figure, in number, people in some nearby Arab cities. Some cities in the Arab world have this population, while Gaza might equal a neighborhood in some Arab countries, particularly in Egypt, for example. So it is a very poor situation, a very weak situation for this population, for these people in Gaza. The people of Gaza are suffering too much, and the statistics figures and all these figures suggest that the situation is getting much worse than ever, unless there is some sort of a political solution for the conflict rather than the economic solution, because economic solution itself cannot help the situation to relieve or to be better. A political solution which will bring some sort of stability and security that will breed some better economy for the people of the Gaza Strip. That's what I can say.
Right, yeah. There is a common misconception here that because Israel is no longer, quote-unquote, occupying Gaza, that the situation should be getting better, that the people of Gaza have the chance to work and build an infrastructure and live happily. But the siege is not what's talked about. No one talks about the siege in Gaza and the maritime siege and the airspace siege and the import siege. So I think it's really important that you brought that up, because it goes right over people's heads. No one realizes that there is still a dire situation in Gaza, and no one knows about it. But I just wanted to go back and talk about the Rafah border crossing. I was wondering what kind of relationship Gaza and Palestinians in general have with Egypt and Egyptians and the Egyptian government. From the way that you described it, it seems like it is still pretty a hostile relationship, but do they help at all? Do they provide supplies for Gazans, or is it mainly just that they open the border and allow a few Gazans in at a time?
Egyptians have not supported in terms of the logistics and in terms of the goods and community supplies, have not much done that for the Palestinians. The only and the main thing Palestinians realize from Egypt is the reopening and the opening of the Rafah crossing terminal, which I referred to in terms of the travelers going back and forth from and to Egypt, actually. The relationship between Gaza and the Gazans and the Palestinians and Egypt is something that is governed by Egyptian strict political strict rules, mainly political. And I can suggest that, and I can say that the consecutive Egyptian governments since the time of the Mubarak regime up to this moment, Egyptian policy has not changed towards Gaza in terms of the border closure of the border, the crossing terminal that Egypt opened. I believe that Egyptians have ever wanted the Palestinians to have an official authority that takes over the situation here in Gaza in order to make things better for the Palestinians. This reminds us with the situation before 2007, particularly following the 2005 agreement for the operation of crossing. This agreement was signed by Egypt, United States, European Union, and Israel, and the Palestinian Authority from the other part. Yes, that's what the official agreement for operating the crossing, which, by the way, you mentioned this, by the way, recently, about a couple of days ago, maybe yesterday, the Palestinian Authority has agreed to remand the mandate of the European observers till 2020. Mm-hmm. That's what has been reported. The Palestinian Authority has agreed to remand or to extend the observers work on the Rafah crossing, which was instated back in 2005 when those parties agreed to the operation agreement of the crossing. That's what the Egyptians wanted, always want an official body. As far as the ruling Hamas party in Gaza, you know that the situation is very tense between Egypt and the Islamic Brotherhood for many years now, since the toppling by the Egyptian military of the former late regime, the former late president of the Islamic Brotherhood, Mohammed Morsi, who died recent, who died this month while observing a court in Cairo. The situation between is very tense since that time, and the Egyptians, along with some other Arab regimes, do not wish to have to deal with the Islamic Hamas party, which is originated from the Islamic Brotherhood, that is being outlawed not only in Egypt but in other Arab countries in the region. That is the situation. Only they want the official body, which is represented by the Palestinian Authority, and know how complicated the situation is between the Palestinian Authority and the ruling Hamas party. The Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is led by Fatah party, and Gaza is being controlled by the Islamist Hamas party, and these two parties have been split since 2007 and have not yet reached any kind of a compromise or deal among each other, so that the Egyptian authorities and other Arab regimes could deal easily with a representative Palestinian body like the Palestinian Authority or the PLO. That is the complicity of the situation. It's merely political and some considerations and some kind of thought in the Arab countries, in Egypt, particularly nearby Egypt. That's what I can just say and analyze about how the relationship is going between Palestinians in Gaza and the Egyptian authorities on the other side of the border.
Yeah, and so you mentioned Hamas, and I wanted to talk about that. So I have been reading a lot about how Hamas has moved away from a religious movement and religious resistance to nationalism and to a national resistance. So could you talk a little bit more about that and their kind of switch? Because Hamas is always talked about as a religious fanatic terrorist group that, you know, fires 20,000 rockets at Israel, and so therefore Israelis need to defend themselves and just bombard Gaza. But in reality,
I do believe that it's not a matter of being Islamist or, Islamist or not Islamist. I do believe that what matters for the world, for the regional countries, the international players in this part of the world, is not what matters for them is not for Palestinians to be either Islamist, leftist, communist, secularist, or whatsoever. What they want from any Palestinian body, and that's what has been what has been and still being stated by the world, the international players, that they want Palestinians to renounce violence, which is resistance, Palestinians, armed resistance against Israel. They want Palestinians to recognize Israel's right to exist. They want Palestinians to go further in peace talks. Even these peace talks have proved to be futile over the past 25 years since Oslo Accords of 1993. So what I do believe is that Palestinians, Hamas, whether it is turning to be rather pragmatist or rather nationalist than being an Islamist, is not working for Hamas and will not work for Hamas, even if it goes further on that. Mm-hmm. But what might work for Hamas is the acceptance or the meeting the three main demands that the international community and the international players had called Hamas to accept, who had demanded Hamas to accept when Hamas took over power by means of democratic elections in 2006. That's what the international community wants Hamas or either Fatah or either any party to accept. And let me just go very, very back, flashback very briefly to the times of the Palestinian president, the late Palestinian president and leader Yasser Arafat, who went further with the Israelis and with the world with peace talks, and the peak of those peace talks was Camp David peace talks 2, Camp David 2 peace talks, which was held in 2000. By then, or before that, prior to that date, Palestinian president was described as a peacemaker, and he won a Nobel Peace Prize. Mm-hmm. A peacemaker. When the situation got worse after the failure of the Camp David talks in 2000, actually, the international community started to look at Arafat as not being a peace mover or a peacemaker. Okay, they started to brand him as someone who is helping terrorize the situation, someone who's helping or fueling tension, fueling terrorism against Israel, between brackets. And Arafat began to be no longer called a peacemaker or a peace initiator. And this, and the epic, it reached the epic by the siege that was imposed in Arafat in 2002, when Israel launched or carried out its offensive, military offensive, larger-scale military offensive on the West Bank, which was called the Defensive Shield. Mm-hmm. You remember, if you remember, mm-hmm. the Defensive Shield ended up by Arafat being besieged in his Muqata'a office in Ramallah and was then pronounced dead. That's really the situation. They want the Palestinians to raise the white flag once and for all and accept whatever they might offer them, the international community. And I can just relate this to the latest Bahrain conference, economic workshop, that was held a couple couple of days ago in Bahrain and is sponsored by the United States administration of a president, of Mr. President Donald Trump, who wants a vision, who wants a peace of his own to be imposed on the Palestinians, an economic peace, only an economic peace that looks for or that that seeks some kind of economy for the occupied Palestinian territories in Gaza and the West Bank, without addressing the root causes of the conflict, and without finding a very just solution for the Palestinian people based on the United Nations Security Council resolutions 242 and 338 of 1967 and 1973, 172 or 3, which demand Israel to immediately withdraw from the Arab territories it occupied in 1967, and including the occupied East Jerusalem, which the President Trump's administration declared as the capital of Israel, the capital of the occupying power. And let me just mention here the Arab Initiative for Peace in 2002 that was initiated by the Arab countries, our countries topped by the Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia did yesterday say clearly that whatever economic plans for the Palestinian people can never work unless the parties concerned, particularly Israel, accept the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002, which demands the withdrawal of Israel from the occupied Palestinian territories that were occupied by Israel in 1967, including the occupied East Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, which is being now declared as the capital of the Israeli state, which already occupied, which is regarded by the international law as an occupying power when it comes to the occupied Palestinian territories, Gaza, West Bank, and East Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, speaking on, you know, Mr. President Trump and Jared Kushner, Kushner came out with the opportunity of the century, you know, which just sounds like another proposed peace plan that does not favor Palestinians. And Kushner also said, this is a direct quote, "My direct message to the Palestinian people is that despite what those who have let you down in the past say, President Trump and America have not given up on you." And to me, this feels just like propaganda, pardon me, propaganda again.
It's only a lip service that has nothing to do with the reality on the ground.
Right.
The American administration, the consecutive American administrations, have really been able to do something for peace in the region. They at least, let me just cite an example, at least the American administration could have prevented Israel from expanding its settlements in the West Bank to the level that Palestinians are being suffocated, the Palestinian towns and villages are being suffocated, strangulated by many settlement blocks that are considered or dubbed illegal by the international law and by the international community based on the United Nations resolutions 242 and 338. In the meantime, on the contrary, the American administration, including the recent administration of President Trump, have allowed Israel, have turned a blind eye and this ear to what's going on, to the bulldozers that have dug the Palestinian land and erected housing units for Israeli settlers on the occupied Palestinian territory. This is only an example. So what is being said now is merely a lip service. Reality on the ground says the opposite, that Palestinians, and I would like to say that any kind of political economic solution of economic development for the Palestinian territories cannot work or cannot succeed because of the fact that Israel is the occupying power. Israel is controlling everything. Israel is controlling everything, the border crossings, the taxes collected, they collect collect the taxes on behalf of the Palestinian Authority. All of these considerations on these and all of these things are being governed by or are being done within the Palestinian within the autonomous rule that was given to the Palestinians back in 1993. So what is needed now is actually reconsideration of all past signed agreements between Israel and the Palestinians and all the parties concerned, including the United States, which is a key, which is the main sponsor for peace talks in the Middle East, for these parties to find a better acceptable agreement for Palestinians and Israelis, rather than the autonomy that is being applied since the Oslo Accord of 1993. That's what I can say.
Okay, right, of course. And going back to just propaganda, and you being a journalist, how do you combat American and Israeli propaganda, which is just rampant in the U.S.? I mean, people are under the impression that Hamas and Gazans and Palestinians are all terrorists, and they're the ones that are instigating violence, and Israel is just, you know, a poor defender that, you know, can't do anything else besides defend their country and defend their country that they tried so hard to create. So how do you push back against that propaganda, and how do you show the truth?
This is something that requires, let me just say, I wouldn't say how can I fight that, because it's not my responsibility as an independent journalist working in this part of the world. That is what I can say. But I can tell you something, that all the time I myself have been looking forward to having some sort of a unified strategy, media strategy, to counter this kind of propaganda, or to counterbalance this kind of a propaganda. This is not my responsibility or my job. This is the job of Palestinian politicians, the official, the non-official, the formal, the non-formal, to have to sit and talk and to find out a strategy, a media strategy that can counter or fight back this propaganda by Israel. And I would like to say that the situation on the ground is very complicated, and there is some kind of a lack of a Palestinian narrative. Well, this is something that I want to say. The lack of narrative is that it plays a very important role in that. Plays a very important role in helping the Israelis to have some kind of a propaganda. Always there is a lack, some sort of lack of narrative when there is some kind of happening or occurrence or incident from here, from time to time, here and there, in the Gaza Strip or in the West Bank. So what I want to say that I would like, through your radio station, I would like to call on all those concerned Palestinians, those concerned with authority, concerned with the Palestinian factions, concerned with those who are having the funds, the needed funds, to support and to formulate and support a media strategy that is able or that can fight back any Israeli propaganda against Palestinians, describing the Palestinians as terrorists.
Well, we can end it on that. Thank you so much, Rami, for joining us today.
You are welcome. Okay. At any time.
Again, that was Rami El-Maghari joining us from the Gaza Strip in Palestine.
Listen to the children of Gaza, Amira Haas. When the Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz gave this talk in Chicago on May 5, 2019, the most recent bombing of the Gaza Strip had entered its third day. Israeli warplanes and artillery had struck more than 100 sites across Gaza, killing 23 people. At the same time, homemade rockets from Gaza struck southern Israel and killed 4 Israelis. Amira Haas is the only Jewish-Israeli correspondent on Palestinian affairs who is living on the West Bank among the people she reports on. She was born in 1956 in Israel to Holocaust survivors. She spoke at the Broadway United Methodist Church in Chicago. Amira Haas.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on this Sunday sunny day, which is much less sunny for us when we know what is going on right now. Shelling of Gaza, rockets launched at Israeli communities on the other side of the border. And this makes my job today very relevant, but also much harder, because I was asked to speak in general about the children of Gaza. But when you suggested this title of children, it brought at the same time a smile on my face, because I could imagine all those children, all these Gazan children that I have known over the years. And then tremendous sadness, because first of all, I am deprived of entering Gaza. I'm not allowed, like all the other Israeli journalists. Since 2006, we are not allowed to enter Gaza. And the journalist that I am, I need things which are very concrete in order to describe. So, you know, I don't want to tell you statistics about Palestinian children. This you can read in books. Reports of the World Bank, for example, that there are the number of children until the age of 15, that 45 or so percent of the Palestinian, of the Gazan population, are children below 15 and below. And about 60% of kids in working age, between 15 to 24, or 25, are unemployed. So all these statistics you can find. I'm not here for giving you statistics. A while ago, I had two things that happened, and you understand why I'm smiling. I got an email by someone who lives now in Amman, in Jordan. I knew him when he was a child, and he reminded me how I played with them. And then I got a note from his cousin. These two kids, Azat and Bashar, have managed to leave, and they prosper outside. They left because having stayed in Gaza would have not allowed them to ever to develop themselves. They miss Gaza. If Gaza were not a huge prison, they would have stayed in Gaza. But this is the minority. How many can arrange this solution for themselves? So I think about all the others, too, that I don't have contact with. For example, in Rafah, I remember in 2004, there was an Israeli invasion for several days and a curfew over the refugee camp in a large neighborhood, when the Israeli army demolished many houses. And kids with their families found shelter in UNRWA schools. In some schools, and I would go to the schools to collect testimonies of families and children about the Israeli army and about the demolition. One of them I remember, and now preparing for the, I thought about him. A huge bulldozer, military armored bulldozer, approached the house while the family was in or almost getting out, and over. A night, that's what his mother told me, over the night, he got white hair. He was, I think, if I remember correctly, around 8 to 9 years old. Then I remember another child, a child of friends of mine in northern Gaza Strip, in Beit Hanun. The soldiers took him as a human shield when they wanted to enter houses and look for explosives or militants, and they took him as human shield. And for years he suffered from a skin rash and completely traumatized. And then I wonder about all the other children that I know that have lived through three major wars and uncounted military invasions and attacks. And now, right now, live under this fear that any moment an Israeli bomb will fall on a nearby house, not on their house, but on a nearby house. I can imagine the terrifying noise of these bombs. I mean, I heard them too. We know, according to UN, UN figures, at least 300,000 children need some sort of psychological assistance, having been traumatized all over these years. It's hard to imagine 300,000 in a population of 2 million. But what about the parents? What about the fathers? What about the mothers? Can you really achieve anything of this psychological assistance or support or protection while the trauma in which you are, I mean, it's not post-trauma, it's a successive trauma. Whenever I have the chance to meet a Palestinian, a young Palestinian, and it is very rare going out of Gaza, I feel awe. I feel I'm full of admiration. 2 years ago, another child of my friends, he came in a group that was the first time allowed to go out of Gaza and to travel in the West Bank and to meet West Bankers, West Bank children. And they were dancing and they were playing music, those children who came now, who came from Gaza. And just 2 years earlier, they went through this war. And they were smiling and they were joking, and he told me things about Hamas with a lot of criticism, but at the same time, he was joking and he was preparing for an exam. And I asked myself, where is the energy from? Where are the talents from? And I say to ourselves, because we think about Gazan in general and Gazans in particular, and children in particular, and Palestinians in general, as the victims that deserve our mercy. And I plead us to say they are wronged. It's a people being wronged for very long, but the title of victim minimizes and limits our understanding of their strength. But when I don't talk about the military attacks and the bombing and the fear of being murdered and wounded, when I don't talk about this, I talk about the prison that Gaza is. While the military situation like today is somehow political decision by both parties, both Hamas and Israeli army, the reality in which Palestinians live in Gaza, which is prison or a huge detention camp, is a totally Israeli human-made reality that is the sole responsible for the disaster in which Gazans live, and that the UN said a disaster that will reach a point in 2020, a point where Gaza will not be anymore livable or habitable. The pollution of water, the pollution of overflowing of sewage, the contamination of the land, of the soil, how I cannot even imagine with what the soil of Gaza is absorbed after all the Israeli bombings. What kind of chemicals or metals have been absorbed there in the soil and in the water? Israel sprays the fields of Gazans with chemicals, with herbicide. Twice a year, these herbicides enter into Gaza, and we know that it is in order to make visibility for the Israel army. How all these things affect people and children. And the fact that children do not know what it is to go beyond 40 kilometer long, 15, 16 kilometer width of Gaza. And I think about the million children that I don't know. This policy, this Israeli policy, and it's very important to remember that it is a policy. And it started as a political measure in 1991. It is then that Israel issued a pass system very similar to that of the apartheid South Africa. Until then, Palestinians had a certain freedom of movement within the country, and they could go between Gaza and the West Bank, and from Gaza to Israel, and from West Bank to Israel, without permits. The rule was that people's right for freedom of movement is respected, including children. And by the way, many children went to Israel to work and started helping their families very early on when they were 14 and 13. They went to Israeli markets and worked there, and to Israeli restaurants and washed the dishes there, and contributed greatly to the economical sustainability of their families. Another admirable aspect of Palestinian children back then. But Israel, at the eve of the negotiations with the Palestinians, first in Madrid and later on in Oslo, Israel changed its policy and decided that Palestinians have to have a personal permit in order to leave each area, either the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. And this runs contrary to a promise made at Oslo negotiations that both Gaza and the West Bank are one territorial unit because they are going to constitute the future Palestinian state. And you ask me why, and I'll tell you, because if this, the Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank, was seen by the world as a basic for the peaceful solution or peaceful settlement between the two sides, and that the Palestinians accepted, fully accepted, Israel did everything possible to foil this possibility of a Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank. And the first condition for this was to disconnect Gaza from the West Bank. The second condition for this was to actually replicate or duplicate Gaza in the West Bank, to create enclaves in the West Bank, Palestinian enclaves, separated from each other, engulfed by an Israeli-controlled territory of settlements and military positions. So the reality today is that we have the enclave of Gaza and several enclaves, Palestinian enclaves, under limited Palestinian self-rule in the West Bank. It's not all the West Bank. It's only 39% of the West Bank. Areas that are disconnected from each other and that Israel can any moment shut down so that they cannot even move from one place to another, just like Gazans cannot move. It is an occupation without direct presence of soldiers, but it is an occupation that is very invasive, military occupation, very invasive, that goes into the details of people's lives, to the extent that people who are married cannot live together in the same place if one is Gazan and one is not, or that they are separated from their own children if one of the spouses is a Gazan and cannot go and live with the children in the West Bank. And the details are many. You know, it never ends. I mean, I can continue and continue. I think that the main demand has to be to lift, indeed, to lift this blockade over Gaza. And this issue is not about Egypt, about the freedom of people to go outside from Gaza and to go to Egypt. First, they have to restore their right for freedom of movement outside of Gaza, either to Israel, historical Palestine, and to the West Bank and abroad, through where it is the easiest and the closest, not Rafah. The natural ties are within the country, Israel, historical Palestine, West Bank, whatever. And this has to be restored, including, of course, the economical restrictions and other things. Otherwise, indeed, Gaza will be totally inhabitable in 2 or 3 or 5 months. Thank you.
You're listening to the Israeli journalist Amira Haas. She spoke in Chicago on May 5, 2019, on the last day of a bombing of the Gaza Strip by Israeli warplanes and artillery, while Hamas was firing homemade rockets into southern Israel. Here now is part of the question and answer session.
On behalf of Jewish people who are struggling with this, who sincerely want to take on what you're telling us, the stories, the actual suffering, but are torn because of their allegiance to Israel and their fear, their concern, reflected or unreflected, that by opening up to this, they are not being loyal to Israel. And being aware that rockets are coming in from Gaza into Israel right now, and Jewish lives are in jeopardy too.
My first answer would be, Palestinians and Israelis are not on a symmetrical stand. Palestinians have a right, and I think also an obligation, to resist Israeli foreign domination. Now, or people may argue about the forms of resistance. People have questions about them. I have my doubts, I have my analysis over Hamas' use of rockets or of militarization. I also think that many Palestinians in Gaza do not think that this is the ultimate way to win. But it's not about two symmetrical powers that fight each other. Allegiance to Israel is already a strange thing for me. This allegiance to Israel reminds me of allegiance of communists to the Soviet Union. In their refusal to know the reality, in their refusal to face the information that flows and shows that this Soviet Union is not your dreamland. I know because I come from a communist family, and I know because I've witnessed my parents struggling with the information. And while I totally still adhere to basics of the socialist and radical socialist ideologies, I also refuse to see the Soviet Union or any other so-called socialist state as a model for me. And I think that the Jews have to think about this comparison and to realize that Israel is not what they have thought about that Israel is or what Israel should be. Unfortunately, with the Oslo process, which I refuse to call peace process, with the Oslo process, Israel proved to itself and to the Israelis and to the Palestinians that it is the settler colonial entity that was always charged with. A charge that it rejected for many years, but here it proves that it is. Because it was so simple to accept the generous Palestinian offer during Oslo and to establish a Palestinian state in Gaza and the West Bank without settlements, with Jerusalem as a capital. Israel did the opposite. Israel did everything to colonize further the West Bank, to decimate the space that is allocated to Palestinians, to fragment Palestinian community into several disconnected communities addressed as individuals and not as a people, not as a collective. It did what settler colonial entities and movements have done for 200, 300 years, and actually proved that 48 and the 30s, and it was the Zionism is a settler colonial movement. So we are in a problem. You are proving what everybody said, what people told about you, and you said that they are anti-Semites, but you are doing this. My aim would be, yes, we should respect as Jews our history. We should never tire to remind people, including Palestinians, that Zionism was not a movement of the majority. Until the late 20s, 1920s, and beginning of the 1930s, the majority of Jews opted for other solutions or other ways to evade or to escape persecution or to challenge persecution. And anti-Semitism and persecution of Jews is not a fairy tale that we tell you. It was real. It was real, but the majority of Jews preferred to remain in the diaspora and to find solutions in the diaspora. I take my parents. They saw the diaspora as their home. My mother is from Yugoslavia, my father is from Romania. These were their homes. But then, with the advent of Hitler to power in Germany and the advent of Nazism, the diaspora gave another message to the Jews. Not only that they are second or third or fourth rate citizens, not only that they are not wanted among these countries, but they are not wanted in this world. And this was a strong message. We should not belittle this. And I'm sure that if United States and Canada had opened their gates to Jewish emigration in the 30s and the 40s, not just, you know, some select celebrities like Einstein or I don't know what, or Hannah Arendt, but the whole, the masses, the proletariat, the poor people, if they had accepted them all, they wouldn't have come to Palestine. They would have been saved, many of them would have been saved, and they wouldn't have emigrated to Palestine. Okay, so Jews came, and it's at the expense of Palestinians. So if we really wanted a refuge, and if we really wanted to build a model society, first of all, we would have accepted the Palestinians back, those who were expelled or ran away or were not in the country in 1948. I know it is, today it sounds completely hypothetical, but we had several opportunities over the years to build another course, not to remain a foreign entity, foreign European entity within an Arab world. We decide to be so, and for this we have to permanently rely on the military strength, expand this military strength, and then export it to the world, and then export it to murderous regimes all over the world for profit. So this is Israel. And I don't think that this is something